The Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and we'll start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 323. And Janet, can you give us a summary again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 323 is the bill that came from the Senate and came out of the work group, the Independent Contractors Task Force that met during the interim. That task force met as a result of Senate Bill 232 last session. It rewrites the definition of independent contractor. Mr. Chair, we had the hearing earlier, and we're not able to finish all the people that were signed up on the hearing list, and so this is a continuation of the hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. And for those that are here to testify, it's my intention today to finish up the public hearing, and then we'll end that for today. I'm not going to work the bill today, so we'll hold it over to Friday's meeting. And could I have Tom Holt, Ed Harnden, and Clark Gallagher?
Sir.
We'll start out with you, Tom. Is okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. Our members are pharmacists and pharmacy technicians around the state. And I'm going to pick up right where you left off the last hearing. You heard from Nancy Cabe, who is one of our members, and she runs a pharmacist brokerage for people who float, what we do call float, as they fill in for people who are on vacation and out sick and things like that. For us, this is the definition of independent contractor then becomes a critical issue of access to care, because pharmacies have such great difficulty, especially in rural areas, getting adequate coverage for taking care of those things. Now, we support the bill because we do see that it is a modest improvement in the law. However, the bill makes us very nervous, and what Nancy Cabe was here asking the committee for and we're asking for is an expression of the legislature's intent that it does, in fact, resolve issues that were discussed by the task force in relation to brokerages for independent contractors. We have some long and sore history, in particular with the Employment Department, on this issue. In Nancy's case, she litigated this issue with the Employment Department, which was repudiated not once, not twice, but three times by Oregon courts, all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court just a couple of weeks ago on rights of due process to get a fair hearing from the Employment Department. So we think it's very important, given that the Employment Department has a long track record of abusing people who are trying to operate as independent contractors, that the legislature provide a very clear direction of intent and provide, going forward, very close oversight of how this statute is interpreted by not only the Employment Department and the other agencies concerned, so that the agencies are, in fact, carrying out the intent of the legislature in drafting this language. We've consulted with counsel. We've consulted with Ms. Cave's counsel. We're assured by the Bar Association's folks in their tax section who were involved in drafting this that the language does, in fact, address the issues of contract brokerages, as well as some other language that makes us a little bit nervous about primary, what is primary use of a home office. For instance, if someone works primarily outside their home but does their paperwork and such somewhere in their house, we believe it's the intent of the bill to give deference to the person who's trying to operate as an independent contractor in that way, and not declare that, well, just because you're not using an entire room means that you're not an independent contractor. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions at all? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clark will...
Sure. I'll give it a shot to get started. Okay. Chairman Brown and members of the committee, actually, I'm Ed Harnden. I'm an attorney with Baron Liebman in Portland. I'm here representing on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. and I can't help but comment that I'm much more comfortable today than the last hearing. Although I learned a lot, I'm more comfortable. I will be very brief in my comments, given the information you have had before you and that you will have the rest of the day. First of all, I want to compliment both the task force and the committee on the work that's gone into unifying the definitions of independent contractor, and the unification was necessary, and I think the work that went into it was very good. And it's clear from a review of the material in the task force report, as well as the material that you have before you, that the bill itself does protect the other portions of those chapters where there are protections for various groups that have been well thought out over a long period of time, and those remain in force. As to the amendment which has been proposed regarding stringers, I have to say that the person who knows most about this is Clark Gallagher with the Hillsborough Argus, and rather than give you my attorney pattern, I'll give you the person who knows the information.
Thank you, Ed. Chairman Alan Brown, distinguished representatives, thank you for allowing me to testify this late in the process. I am Clark Gallagher, publisher of the Hillsborough Argus, and the reason for my tardy entrance in this process is to answer Senator Williams' broad brush swipe at the amendment proposed to Senate Bill 323. Over the last year, 30 years, I've been publisher or general manager of daily and weekly newspapers in Oregon. From the Springfield News, Cottage Grove Sentinel, Lebanon Express, Albany Democrat Herald, Newport News Times, and now the Hillsborough Argus, stringers are a vital part of our industry, our communities. They reflect what happens where we cannot be because of our limited resources, and we can choose to print what they give us or not. Some are former employees headed to an exotic destination. A story from Japan or Israel has high readership appeal from a familiar writer. Some are kids at an away game with a camera. Some have a passion for gardening, carpentry, or stockbroking. What these independent writers and artists are is one of the most important facets of what make up a community newspaper. And for that, we pay them for the story. But it has not been at our direction, and we have the right to refuse it if it doesn't fit. Why do we pay them if they would give it to us for free? We have copyright laws that trump this bill. Without this amendment, we would be subject to enhanced enforcement interpretations by labor, revenue, and insurance departments of the state of Oregon. In short, gentlemen, it would stop the flow of information from the communities to the media. Stringers are not employees and may not be independent contractors by the strictest definitions. Most of these folks have a talent for writing or photography. They want to share it with their neighbors through their local newspaper. So we are the enablers, creating a win-win-win situation, a win for our community of readers, a win for the newspaper, and a win for the individual. I thank you for your attention, and I thank you for the time that you put in as legislators. Thank you.
Thank you, Clark. Any questions? Representative Kitts.
Clark, I appreciate the you being down here, obviously my hometown newspaper. If I were currently working on a story, which I could be,
okay,
and I wanted to have it published in the Hillsborough Argus, and I sent it to you, and you said I'd do it for free. How does that play into this whole?
We have a forum for that, and it's called our editorial page, and we have a.
No, Clark, I was thinking more like the front page. What story that I'm.
Well, now, if you happened to be at the airport last night.
With pictures.
With pictures.
If you had a story that you wanted to submit to us from some location or other than an opinion, it was an actual story,
right.
Then I would take a look at it to see if it fit into our product or not. And if it did, I'd say, fine, submit it, and we'll pay you for it.
So you would I guess voluntarily offer. I mean,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now we have other things that are known as the community page, to where people will submit events that happen in their lives. You know, a birthday or an anniversary, or they got a new boat or something, and they submit a photo and you know, some cut lines and whatever else, and we'll run that free gratis. Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
I'll get that story to you real soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Remember readership interest.
Yes.
Let's see. Could I have Roger Martin, Jim Colton, and Grover Simmons, please?
That's good.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm a lobbyist. I have two mortgage broker clients, and we're very concerned about Senate Bill 323. Let me go back a moment. I was involved a session ago. This whole argument starts back in the late 1980s when the contractors, the construction industry, and the trade unions were in a debate about how they were going to define independent contractors, and they were thinking of the construction model. They worked out an agreement that was fine and worked at that time, and I simply present to you that that's fine, and I have no problem whatsoever with that issue. But in the ensuing 15 years, the business place has changed mightily in the state of Oregon. We now have people that own laptop computers and cell phones and conduct business totally different than the rules that were written back then. I ran afoul of this myself. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Transit Association. And 5 years ago, we hired one of Representative Brown's constituents who had run the local bus system in Newport for a number of years. She was retired, living on the Siletz River. We needed to organize a statewide organization to come to the legislators 4 years ago and talk about an issue. She knew everybody involved in the state, so the Oregon Transit Association signed a contract with her. You organize this. You answer to an employee who happened to be at TriMet, who Bernie Bottomley, some of you may remember. Bernie will coordinate your activities. She never once came to the office in Salem or in Lake Oswego. She worked for us on contract for 5 months, and at the end of that session, which I believe was either 2001 or 1999, she filed for unemployment. And I got the notice from the Employment Division, and I wrote back and I said, she doesn't deserve this at all. She was an independent contractor totally. Wrong. I was called in and in not very friendly language pointed out, did she do this? Did she have business cards? Well, no, she didn't have any business cards. She was retired. She was doing one contract. Does she have other customers or other clients? No, she doesn't. Does she advertise? No. Well, then you're guilty, and you're going to pay back taxes on this plus a fine. And there, because, you know, you're not the kind of upstanding citizen you ought to be. Now, that's an attitude, and you heard this earlier, that comes from the Employment Division. And I want you to listen to what Jim Colton has to say. Jim Colton and John Mason own Vista Mortgage, a small company in Lake Oswego. I've known both of them for 30 years. They're fine, long-time businessmen, community activists, done all kinds of good things. In 15 years in the business, they've never had a complaint filed against them. They're about to be run out of business by the Employment Division. And that's why something needs to be done on this. And Jim, now that I've built that up, you might even make the front page of the Hillsborough Argus.
Well, be careful what you wish for.
Mr. Chairman, I just heard Mr. Martin's going to get the Hillsborough Argus endorsement.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this story isn't just about our company, but it is all, it's the industry itself, the mortgage broker business. We have been in business for 15 years. We've had zero complaints from the state of to the state of Oregon in our business handlings. We had two audits come back to back within like 7 days of each other. One was from the Employment Division. The other one was from our actual licensing division. The Employment Division audit came to the conclusion that we had a serious fine in back taxes. We've been operating our business for 15 years. Based on a CPA that has been our CPA and also a bookkeeper. We've been told that we were operating exactly in order. When we got the fine from the Employment Division, we called and asked for a hearing. We did not receive a hearing, but I met with two fellows at the Employment Division and basically talked about what we thought we could do. We questioned whether we're independent contractors or not, but we offered them a compromise, and that was that we would pay for 2004's employment and get current on 2005 and then fight the issue, but get back into the income stream that they want. Their answer was no. They put out a warrant for our assets immediately, and that was for equipment and our checking account, our business account. I'm meeting with them tomorrow by the person who absolutely said no. They would rather have their fine right now and watch us go out of business than let us continue with a compromise that keeps us in tow, that will allow us to fight or at least argue our situations as independent contractors. Our licensing division came in a week later, and I don't know, this is the big kick, said these are not independent contractors. I don't have offices for these people. They have laptops and cell phones. We have an office where we process loans. We have a brokerage that handles about 75 lenders, probably 300,000 products if you ever try to figure out what kind of loan to get. They want each loan officer now to become a branch office. And each we have 11. That would be a cost of $500 each to set up, plus a bonding issue that would be probably $5,500, $6,000. But Vista Mortgage Inc. is talking about here is, do we qualify for unemployment benefits of the people that work for us? The answer is no. A loan officer leaves our company under one of two circumstances. They either quit to go somewhere else, or we would terminate them on malfeasance. Either case, they cannot collect unemployment benefits. What the employment division is saying, they want to tax us back to a point where even if they were employees, wouldn't qualify for benefits because it's beyond the two-year statute. But they want to tax us back that far. We've had no offer and compromise hearing by the employment division. They haven't given it to us. We had to hire an attorney, which, you know, here's another expense. The attorney had finally got them to admit that they didn't set a hearing, so they're going to have a hearing. But in the meantime, they put out the warrant to shut us down. Between these two departments, between the unemployment division and our licensing department, I feel that the state's intent is to close me down. And it's not their intent to get us in the stream, if that's what we offered to do while we battle this issue. I just feel it's unfair, harassing. It's anti-business, it's expensive, and it will cause me to have to close. I've already told my wife the backup plan is we'll have to go to work for somebody else until they shut them down. That's the attitude of the state, and that's where I feel. I'm done. Thank you.
May I add just what he was talking about? The term loan originator is the many independent mortgage brokers use individuals who bring loan offers to them, and those are the people that he's talking about who the state thinks should be employees, even though they don't maintain an office there. They work independently. It's very similar to the real estate industry, which is in this case exempt. In both the states of California and Washington, loan originators are considered independent contractors, and the federal government's not chasing anybody on this. It's the state of Oregon. It's got a different attitude about it.
Mr. Chairman, may I address one? Members of the committee. The situation in... God, what's my train of thought? We're talking about... I have to pass.
Roger, can you tell me, you say in California and Washington... The loan originators are an independent contractor. Are they? Do they meet a criteria to get there, or are they just a special carve out in the legislation to allow them to be there?
Mr. Chairman, the mortgage broker business in California and Washington are actually operated under the real estate division. And so, and the real estate divisions are exempt. Now, the real estate industry here is exempt, although we operate identical to them. In fact, they're probably more independent than them. We don't have floor time. We don't have sales meetings. And we don't buy them business cards. The real estate industry is exempt, and I asked the employment division that very question. You know, why are they exempt and we aren't? Because we're identical. All we deal with is real estate agencies, and they know exactly what it's about. And they said, well, this was an answer from, I think it was Bob McQuinlan. He said, well, the problem is it's politics. You're not exempt. And they are. And the issue is, he said, you need to band together and hire lobbyists, get some attorneys, and force it down their throat that you should be exempt like the real estate division. I find that unfair. The answer is, Washington, California do operate as independent contractors. How they're exempt, I don't know.
Okay, thank you. I was representing Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, are your loan originators, are they paid with commission? Or is that how you pay them? Is through through commission solely?
100% commission.
Thank you.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, you are providing, or you don't have a contract agreement that they have to work there so many hours a week or a month, or you don't provide them with health insurance or workman's comp, is that correct?
We provide no benefits, have no requirements of their time.
It's a strict commission basis?
It's 100% commission.
And do they have to be licensed?
That's a good question. No. In Washington and California, they do. In the state of Oregon, they are not licensed individuals. They have to be registered, and they take a 20-hour exam, but they do not receive a license. In fact, we have to pay for the exam. We get a certificate saying they've completed their 20 hours, register them with the state. I faxed down a certificate of completion for first loan officer we had to do this for. They called us up and said, we don't need it. So then why are we doing this? They don't. All they do is register their name.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Roger, I think that the story that you told first is, and I want you to get me there, I think the story that you told first is a little different than Jim?
Yes.
Just told. And I say that because it appears that in the first story, an entity goes to someone and says, I want you to do a job. Because of X, Y, and Z. In this case, they knew everybody. That, to me, is not going to somebody and contracting with them because they don't have an established business. They're not in the business of doing what it is that you're asking them to do. So you're not going to Roger Martin and Associates and saying, hey, I'm Derek Kitts, Inc. I have an issue before the legislature. You know everybody. This is what you do. Can I retain you on contract? You wouldn't be an employee of me. I'm hiring you for a specific service. In a situation where you just go to the person off the street, whomever, and say, you don't have an established business. You're not in the business of doing this. You don't have business cards. You don't have letterhead. You don't actively seek business to do this. But because of the fact that you know X, Y, and Z, I'm hiring you. In my mind, I think that's a little bit more gray than what Jim's talking about. So I want to make the distinction between the committee that I don't lump in this whole testimony as a specific case to be made for this. And I think that in the case of the newspapers, they can say, based on my example, I send in something. I'm sure they have staff writers that write consistently and are employed by the newspaper as opposed to other folks that contribute on a not-so-regular basis. So that's the distinction that I make. I don't know that I would go so far as to say that in your situation, yes, that person is an independent contractor. Now, in the case of Jim, I think he merits a good case. And I just wanted to make that clear for the committee that I don't view this testimony as one big case because I think there's different issues, and we could debate those.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, I agree with you because I ran afoul of the old law before the 2003 session changed it, where it was very specific because it was written for a totally different kind of thing. And my point is, as far as I'm concerned, don't change at all the contracting industry and the trade unions. They worked out an agreement. That's fine. Don't change that. But there's a whole world out here of people doing business in a different manner. My son is an independent contractor. Happens to work for the federal government, so state, go ahead and sue them. But he doesn't qualify as an independent contractor under those rules.
Doing a good job being an employee.
But he's doing contract. He's a computer genius. Something that didn't exist back in the 1980s when this was written.
Mr. Chair. Representative Shoffler.
Mr. Martin, don't suggest we sue the federal government. I think we're doing a good enough job in that area. Right? I have a question, but I want to hear what Grover has to say.
He's next up.
Okay. Before I
you want to wait?
Yes, please.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and Grover?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Employer Association, and today I'm speaking on behalf of the travel industry. I'm new to this subject, having been contacted about 1 week ago. I want to continue the discussion that was started just a few days ago at the last meeting of the committee and enhance a couple of points and defer to the experts in the audience for any kind of a technical question. But at the last meeting, the chairman authorized us to request an amendment from Legislative Council, which we have done, and each of you has a copy of that amendment. It's a one-sentence amendment as far as its operative language. It says, employment does not include services performed by a travel agent for a host agency if the travel agent is compensated by the piece or per ticket or on a flat rate or commission basis. That's the operative language. But what I wanted to expand upon is what the ladies who testified last week said, that the travel industry is truly in a period of transition, almost a shakedown situation. The airlines began putting a squeeze on local travel agencies hard time a few years ago. They reduced their commissions time after time. They finally got down to a $10 per ticket commission rate, and then, believe it or not, they went to zero. So travel agents receive zero commission for booking a ticket for all of us. So they're down at ground zero. But all of this has forced a reorganization of the way business is done. And Roger Martin just made a marvelous comment, doing business in a different manner. That's what's happening in the travel industry, as well as obviously other industries that are concerned about whether you're an independent contractor or not. At the federal level, we've just experienced United Airlines declaring bankruptcy and turning over their pension to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Board. You're talking about hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars. Well, that's the federal level. At our level, where we're talking about one travel agency at a time, you have to do business in a different way to survive. And that's what the testimony last week said. But the one point I want to elaborate on is that the Department of Employment audited an agency, and the point they hung their decision on was, well, you have a number from the Airline Reporting Corporation. And the Airline Reporting Corporation is a national organization that issues a master number to each travel agency. And so if somebody is doing business through that travel agency, they use that agency's Airline Reporting Corporation number, their ARC number. Now, if you're an independent contractor working out of your home, which is what we're concerned about and what we're trying to cover, you can place a ticket request or ticket order through any number of agencies. And when you do that, you have to use that agency's master number. So you could place tickets with, we'll say, 10 or 15 different agencies, maybe during a year. Are you employed by 10 or 15 different companies? No way. That's unreasonable. But the Department of Employment said if you use another person's or somebody else's Airline Reporting Corporation master number, which is required, you are an employee. So I submit that the Department of Employment misinterpreted the facts and that their conclusion is wrong. Let's see.
Good job, Roger.
I guess you
grow over.
Surely.
Roger, is this your first time at the Capitol?
Yeah. I'm used to Roger interrupting me. I don't mind at all.
I think it's the employment department calling this department.
got me again.
Ed Hardin testified, the attorney testified from Baron Liebman a few minutes ago. That's one of the best law firms in Oregon, and our amendment parallels the newspaper amendment, so I think we're in pretty good hands from a point of view of using common language. We use language like piecemeal and flat rate and so forth. So I thought we are in pretty good hands by paralleling what the fancy lawyers have written for the newspapers. And one final point, Mr. Chairman, is that I told you I'm new to the cause. During the interim, the study committee, the task force that was up and operating, my clients didn't even know about that. That's not my fault. But if anything were to go on in the future, you can believe that they would be apprised before sundown if it affects our business. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Grover. Representative Shaw, sir.
Anyway, I'm glad to hear we've taken the construction contractors and the building trades off this conversation. I'm grateful for that. You know, somehow we have to establish who's a business and who's an employee, and there has to be a bright line. And if you're a business, somehow you have a license and insurance and bond, and you take care of your own thing. If you have employees, you take care of their workers' comp, unemployment, all that stuff. Somehow we need to draw that line, and I know it's rather difficult. And I agree with my good friend from Hillsborough, North Plains. There are different situations going on here and that are markedly different. I guess my question to you is, and you don't have to do this now, I would like the names of the people that have bad attitudes. Whether I agree with them or not, that's what I'd like. You don't have to share it now. If you don't want to, if you want to put it on public record, that's fine too. But I may well come down in agreement on their interpretation, but a bad attitude really makes my job a lot harder. That has to stop, if nothing else.
Representative Shoffler, are you asking for the names in the employment division?
Any government employee that has a poor attitude and treats people poorly, I'm interested in finding out who they are.
Well, it's a long list.
It's a long session, too, sir.
Representative Kitts.
How do you follow that? Just make sure you don't spell my name wrong. I don't need that. Grover, you brought up an interesting point, and I don't want to take the committee's time to debate it. If you don't agree with me, then I know the chairman's not going to move this bill today. More than happy to discuss it in my office. But where I would take exception with the example and the parallel between what are the -5 amendments and the -7 amendments that you spoke of, these travel agents that you are referring to are required to use an agency number.
Yes, sir.
They are obviously not able to get the agency number themselves, otherwise they would be an agent. Correct?
Yes.
So, with my logic, for these folks to do business, they are reliant upon somebody else. They couldn't do what they're trying to do without going through someone else, an agency. And if they go through 10 agencies, I think that in my case, I would look at that as they do have 10 employers because they couldn't conduct business independently of those agents. That's my concern, and I think that's why what you're proposing is different from what the newspapers are proposing, because if I'm going to write a story, I don't have to go, I'm independent, truly. I write my story, I submit it, they take it or they don't take it. If I want to book an airline ticket, mm-hmm. I have to go through someone who then has to go through someone else in this case. So they, in my estimation, are not truly an independent contractor. They're reliant upon somebody else, and I think that in that situation, the employer, who is obviously gaining benefit, maybe I'm wrong, if I'm using someone's ARC number, as you referred to it,
right.
And I'm getting compensation because I'm selling tickets, but I'm going through an agency, I'm assuming that the agency that I'm going through is getting some form of compensation also for the tickets that I'm booking.
That's true.
So you know, I don't want to waste the committee's time in debating back and forth, but I'll tell you, that's my concern, and that's why I differentiate the dash sevens at first blush from the dash fives for that reason.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, I referred to the newspaper analogy only because it was so well drafted and
right.
Used flat rate and piecemeal, and
right.
That was what we're trying to accomplish as well. I'd be, Mr. Chairman, I'd be delighted to discuss that with you. I think the use of this master number needs to be expanded on in a more extensive discussion. We would argue that that doesn't convert you into an employee, even though the national organization says in order to sell tickets, you have to have a number from somebody. And it's your choice. You can go to any of these places to book your ticket through and use that agency's number within the national required system. That's the way it works. And I submit that's not strong enough to render this person at the local level working out of their home as an employee. But that's maybe a different opinion.
Mr. Chair, very briefly.
Representative Shaw.
You know, I have a general contractor's license. I have, it's inactive, so because my wife didn't want me paying liability and bond insurance on my truck when I'm not here, if I'm being here not building in America. But when I am, I have all that stuff. And if I do 20, 30, 40 jobs a year, I don't have 20, 30, 40 employers. I have 20, 30, 40 customers. And I think a travel agent should have to have a license, somehow differentiating them from an employee, and somehow that process. Same with loan originators. That's what we need to establish here, because then they are an entity onto their. And I know we have these criteria. Do they meet them or not? But if you're in a gray area, what's going to continue to happen is people are going to come back here. We've had this conversation 2 years ago and probably 10 years before that. It's going to continue to go on. So somehow, got to figure out who's what. And you can't say, well, they aren't, but maybe they are. Somehow I have to draw a bright line. This loan originator is their own business. They have their laptop. They do their own work. They're taking care of themselves. Same with the travel agent. Now, how we get there, I don't care how we get there. But I don't want this coming back every 2 years. I'm afraid it probably will. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kitts.
When we were talking, and correct me if I'm wrong, because the chair is familiar with this issue from two sessions ago when we were dealing with the wild rabbit from Blatchley.
Laughing rabbit.
The laughing right. rabbit from Blatchley that assembled these photon laser lights. And the individual that owned the company and would obviously purchase the stuff would subcontract out to a bunch of independent contractors to do work in their home. My argument at the time was there is a set... Thank you, Representative. There is set criteria, was it 24? I can't remember the bill number, I apologize. But in your situation, Roger, your individual could have paid, at the time I think it was $35, we've raised it to $50, to go down and file an LLC with the state saying I'm lobbyist X and pay $50 to have business cards, and then you go to that person and say, we'd like to hire you, your business with the state. I deem that to be an independent contractor, just as I did last session with we called them the widget manufacturers. You know, each one of those individuals was making, you know, I think if the chair will correct me if I'm wrong, between $15 and $20 an hour, you know, mothers working at home while their kids were there. And I said, all they would really, and we had the employment department, all they would have to do by the criteria that's outlined is go register with the state, get a business card, and call themselves a person that has the services available to manufacture these widgets. Now, whether or not they have one client or 10 clients in this case, they would have the ability to have more, thus they would qualify as an independent contractor. And if memory serves correctly, the employment department said, yes, you could do that. The objection to it was, well, it'd be a pain. Well, I'm not going to get there on, oh, okay, it's a pain to do that because I've done it. And if I can do it, I'm sure those folks can do it. So that being said, that to me is an independent contractor. And we've defined that one session prior, but those people weren't reliant upon anybody to do business. If they didn't want to work for that individual that was giving them the business of the Laughing Rabbit, they could, in fact, go somewhere else. They weren't. Mm-hmm. There was no stipulation, i.e. an ARC number, to be able to do business. So that's. I just want to give you the genesis of why I'm not exactly there with your amendments, and I am with the other folks. But again, I'm more than open to discuss that.
Thank you. Is there any other questions?
No.
Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
These people. Could I have Ed Glad, please? Ed?
You're right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Ed Glad. I represent the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. And I was fortunate to be able to sit on the Independent Contractors Task Force through the interim. I wanted to take exception to one of the things that Roger Martin said, that this all started back in the late 80s. This actually started a long, long time ago in terms of the relationship between an employer and employee. In fact, the law that we would default to on January 1st, 2006 is the federal standard, which is based on common law that goes back to the English law. The language that's used throughout the United States, though, started to change at the end of the Civil War, or probably a little bit prior to the Civil War, as the northern states were starting to redefine the relationship between slaveholders and those who were not slaveholders or those who were employees. So when you look at the 50 states here in the United States, there's 46 states that have made a departure from the independent contractor's definition and test that the federal government holds. The last one to come online was the state of Montana, which was last year. They had been working with the federal statute up until last year, and they realized that there was a big problem among their employees that were coming to the state saying, you know, I'm injured or I'm unemployed and I want unemployment to recover my unemployment insurance, but they had never been, those accounts had never been opened with the employers that they were working for. To go a little bit further, when you look at the statutes in Alabama, Kentucky, Mississippi, and even Minnesota, the relationship between master and servant is still embodied in the law and the language that they use in their statutes. And so this is a very old, old problem with regards to who is an employee and who's not an employee. As a member of the Independent Contractors Task Force, several of the conversations that we had a lot to do with the choice that people make. Am I an independent contractor? When you have a bright line standard, as Representative Kitts was describing, was needed in the law, am I an independent contractor? The opportunity to actually conform to the expectations that the law describes in that bright line standard that's put out there is actually there's something to shoot for. How can I describe my activities and my business within the context of what the state is requiring to say that I'm an independent contractor? On the reverse side of that, and why the construction industry and myself as a representative of carpenters comes into it, we find over and over again some of our representatives that work on the street that go to jobs after job after job have estimated that there's over $1 billion of untaxed wages that are out there because people are being told that they're independent contractors. They're not asserting themselves, I'm an independent contractor. They're being told that they're an independent contractor. They're being dealt with in terms of taxation and insurance and all the other accoutrements of having employees as independent contractors. They fall off the radar screen. Why this is so critical for the construction industry now is as we are going through a new wave of immigrants that are coming into this country, we're finding that there are people that are abusing the statutes with regards to independent contractors by saying, I am an independent contractor. What they do is then they hire 40 or 50 immigrants that are perhaps legal, perhaps not legal, paying them cash under the table, taking the pay from the general contractor to the independent contractor, bringing in a whole crew of people to work on the weekend or at night when the rest of the construction crews aren't there. The job gets done, the money exchanges hands, and then it's paid under the table to what we would naturally call employees. So What you have before you in this 323 is a lot of work over the course of a year. Representative Brown knows the work that we did. And this is probably good government at its best, where you had an effort to create a bright line standard in the late 1980s, and then we find that the form of commerce that we have in the state of Oregon has changed. It's developed. There's new forms of relationships between employees and employers, as well as between employers and subcontractors. And the Independent Contractors Task Force was well represented by many of the different sectors. They worked very diligently, and they tried to be as common as possible to all the different sectors, recognizing that every sector knows that there's nuances to the types of relationships that they have. So this is a revision of that law, and it is a critical element that we have, that we do not revert to the common law of the federal government and basically fall off the map or fall into the category of the four or five states that do not have definition of independent contractors and employees as a bright line standard. Thank you for hearing me out, and open to any questions.
Representative Shoffler.
Then more a comment, Ed, than anything else. You know, as a contractor in my world, when Gary's a finisher that helps me pour all kinds of concrete, he is a contractor. I'm required to have a certificate of insurance if he comes on a job site as a contractor. Dave pumps my concrete, the same exact thing. And you know, if whether I be a loan originator or a travel agent or a pharmacist or whatever, that should be the same criteria. And if I'm not doing that on my job site, Gary and Dave don't have licenses and they come and work, then I'm required to provide all the taxes and benefits and wages that go along with me being a contractor. And somehow along the line, some people aren't seeing this, and we just need to apply it. And I don't want to drag contracting into this, but that same mode, that same methodology into everything else. And if I'm a travel agent and I'm working with somebody else, I should have to show I have a license, I'm licensed, I'm doing this, and I'm contracting with any number of businesses. So, or whatever the trade may be. I don't see why it's so difficult, but apparently it is.
It's very difficult, Representative Brown and Representative Shoffler. I think Bob Shipwreck, if he's in the room now, he has the best illustration of this, is that it is not uncommon to have an independent contractor roofing a house. And unfortunately, he falls off the roof, and by the time he leaves the gutter, he becomes an employee. And the Workers' Comp Division probably has plenty of stories to tell you about that. Or the fellow that goes to work with his truck, and by the time he's leaving work, he thinks that he should be going to the Employment Department to collect his unemployment check when he was in fact being treated as an independent contractor. That we choose to be an independent contractor, that we go into business, that we assert ourselves, that we want to be independent and not be an employee, that we want to have direction and control of ourselves and our time, is the criteria I think that we all looked at on the Independent Contractors Task Force in order to be able to create just a baseline here and open the discussion for all the different industries to say, well, wait a minute, we've got something else to do. That should be done at a different time, that this legislation should move as it is, and at a different time, make the case for the various industries and sectors of the economy to define why their nuanced industry needs to be different than what the bright line standard is for the default for all employers and employees.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ed, thank you for testifying today. I've read this bill several times, and I'm glancing over it again. You talked about a general contractor hiring a subcontractor for a job, and that subcontractor paying people under the table. That's currently illegal right now.
Absolutely. And I think that what we're doing in terms of opening up the can of worms of who is and who is not an independent contractor is to actually say, look, we are serious in this state about how you treat your employees. And if there was any confusion before, We have reopened this. We have taken a look, and this is what we believe is the way it's going to be. And so there is an inspiration to enforce those standards. In fact, you're right. It is against the law. I would suggest that virtually anybody in any sector in this room.
I do have a question.
Okay.
Ed, I don't want to interrupt you, but I'd like to ask my question, if possible. You talked about the tax revenue, and God bless you for talking about tax revenue, that we lose. If I'm an independent contractor, I still pay taxes on that money. If I don't pay taxes, I'm in violation of not just state, but the feds. So I guess whether I'm an independent contractor or I'm an employee, now granted, the liability of the taxes shifts depending on which of those categories I fall under. But I'm wondering, so that aside, how is there lost revenue? Where's the lost revenue comment that you make come there? Because whether I'm independent or employee, taxes are being paid.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts. In fact, those that are attempting to fall differently than they naturally should, to classify people as independent contractors when they're not, are attempting to skirt the law.
I understand, I won't disagree that some people probably... May I follow up? I apologize.
Follow up.
I would agree with you that there are those that would try to define somebody as an independent contractor and not employee for the purposes of not paying the taxes that go along with being an employer.
Right.
But if, in fact, somebody is operating as an independent contractor, whether they should or shouldn't be, if I say, Ed, I want you to run my campaign as an independent contractor but not as an employee of Derek Kitts for state representative, and I'm wrong in that, then I'm liable because I have misdeemed that, and there are appropriate actions and avenues to go down if, in fact, I think we heard several cases where, okay, I'm wrong, I'm liable for those taxes. But even if I'm wrong or if I'm right, for the purposes of me writing you a check out of my campaign for services, whether I've misclassified you or not, you're still liable for taxes, or someone is. So,
correct.
So there's no getting around the liability of taxes, whether you're an independent contractor or employer. So I don't think that the statement that you made that billions of dollars being lost is an accurate statement. Because I don't think that you're losing tax revenue. You may be shifting the burden of who's liable for that tax, but you're not losing it. Is that fair to say?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I'm not exactly sure that it's fair or not fair. I think that what is realistic to say is that those people who do not intend themselves to be independent contractors, who find out at tax filing time that they have a liability that they have no capacity to pay, is where we lose our revenue. That if I operated as an employee, thought that my employer was taking money out of my paycheck or out of the wad of money that he was doing in order to meet the obligations of my taxes, and then go to file my short form or my 1040 long form and find out that, hey, you know what, there was nothing withheld, but I don't have anything, then the burden becomes a problem of the state and or the federal government to go and collect those taxes, and you can't take blood out of a turnip.
I can I follow up?
Hold on.
I would agree with that. I think that this is similar to a lot of legislation that we've done in the building, and that's taking an elephant gun to a squirrel. My concern there is, why not simply require an employer upon hiring somebody, whether it's independent or an employee, to disclose up front saying, you're going to get a 1099 or you're going to get a W-4. Plan accordingly.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, that actually was a part of the discussion in the Independent Contractors Task Force. And from my understanding from the tax bar, as well as a couple of the different sectors that were represented, I think it was out of the out of the electronics industry that they were saying that would not meet the criteria either with the federal standard or with the state standard. But that was actually a part of the discussion and one of the options that was, you know, that was presented.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ed. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I see Bob Shiprack sitting there, and I remember very well three sessions ago when I first started getting involved with the independent contractors that he warned me that this was a tar baby that you can't get loose from. And I didn't follow the advice very well. Could I have Chris Da Silva and Paula Hobble, please?
Mr. Chairman, you know to listen to Bob.
I should have this time around. Okay. I know you ladies testified here the other day when we were first hearing this bill, so if you have anything to add to your testimony, and I see you have the amendments, did you want to talk to them? Or?
Yes, Representative Brown. Chairman Brown and committee members, my name is Paula Hobble. I have been in the travel industry since 1967 and owned an Oregon agency since 1988. I would like to say that we do like many things about this bill. However, we are a unique industry. Let me clear up immediately that Grover Simmons did a fine job representing us. However, please realize that selling airline tickets is one part of our industry. And currently, you can go to the internet and do not need that special number. Agents who are independent contractors in the travel agency industry do not have to always use that number. What happened with the agency that was audited, if an agent writes one airline ticket, and all the other sales they did were cruises, they can do that with another travel agency. They can do that on their very own. They can get their own numbers to sell cruises, to sell most everything. But in writing an airline ticket, it is very expensive, very difficult, and they only will let storefront agencies get this special ARC number. So if they want to write an airline ticket to service their customers, if they are an LLC, which many are, if they have business licenses, which working through us they do, if they have their own errors and omissions insurances, all of that meet every criteria from this bill or past bills, if they write one airline ticket, they are considered an employee, and all of that work, according to the Employment Department, is now employee work for the agency. It's very burdensome, and it doesn't understand our industry. We're very much like real estate agents. As 9/11 happened, terrorism attacks continually worry travelers. Many of the incidents, the poor economy, SARS, a world epidemic that suddenly stopped many of our people from going to Asia. As these things happen, many very small agencies close. They go home or they rent space from another travel agency. They run their own business through that, their own clientele. If they can't work in Oregon, because we're also worried that the Employment Department is going to grab us for one airline ticket, and the language in this bill, although very good, still could allow them to do that from our legal representation telling us, they will go out of state. Here is a whole list, which I will give to be given out to you, of out-of-state and internet travel host agencies that are now soliciting people in Oregon, travel agents independent in Oregon, and saying, come work for us. The state of Oregon is not going to bring their employment department over here and audit us in Illinois, in New York, in California. And they're doing the very same thing they're doing with us, but they don't have to worry about being audited. And then that millions of dollars that they represent, because a good independent agent takes from probably about $50,000 in gross sales a year to over $1 million per agent that they handle. That's the gross sales. They make very small amount in commission or in payment for that. But those gross sales will go out of the state and they will be processed through another state. And that's why it is important, we feel, that we have special language so that they will stay in Oregon and the revenue and their business will stay in Oregon.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Do travel agents have to get a license to do business in the state of Oregon? What's the process for you all?
Currently, travel agents do not have to get a license. They do, most all of ours get a business license for where they operate. Mm-hmm. But they are not required to get a license. And travel agencies that work in Oregon do require that they show skills or that they have either owned an agency in the past or have some type of background to show that they've been in the business.
Follow up.
Do you have to legally operate in Oregon? Do you have to have some kind of insurance or bond or pass a criminal check? Is there any process? Or can I just say, I'm a travel agent?
Well, I don't know if you could just say Representative Schaffler, but since you're a contractor.
Well, travel, I know that.
But technically speaking, you could probably study a course or you could tell your friends you're a travel agency. You're a travel agent, I mean. And that's why it's important that travel agents work under and through legitimate travel agencies as independent contractors, or when they are doing their business, they can show that they have some.
I just have to say this, Mr. Chair. You know what? If you're a contractor, there has to be some kind of differentiation between an independent contractor who's a business person who's mm-hmm. responsible for their own workman's comp, unemployment, all that stuff, and an employee. And that's what we need. And then we wouldn't be here having this struggle. That's what we need. Now, I know that's more bureaucracy, and I know it's fees, and I know all that stuff. But I'm telling you, this is maddening. If the gentleman was in here earlier, if as my good friend said, had folks went down and filed with the Secretary of State, I'm a business, they would avoid all this. They wouldn't be going back to 2002 having to repay all kinds of taxes and fees. That's what we need to avoid. So somehow we got to get there.
Many of them have, many of them have become LLCs or corporations themselves. So they are filing with the state. They are independent businesses. I don't think that is an issue. If they have, they don't have to have a license to say they're a travel agent. But they do, if they're an independent contractor, often have business licenses.
If I read the statutes right, forming an LLC or an S-Corp or an assumed business name does not necessarily qualify you to be an independent contractor.
No, but that does show you're an independent business.
Yes, but not necessarily meeting the requirements to be an independent contractor, if I'm reading them right. Mm-hmm. Chris, would you give your testimony?
I'm Chris DeSilvia, and thank you for listening to my testimony again today. I wanted to, first of all, I'm aware that several of you received emails yesterday, perhaps even more today. We have asked agents that are in support of the amendment to please contact you. There are a few agents that are here today, and I would like to ask them, if I may, to please stand. I'm not certain how many are here, but I would like to at least have them identified so that you know that Paul and I are not the only individuals interested in this subject.
Welcome to the Capitol.
I wanted to expand a little bit on the issue of ARC. And the Airline Reporting Corporation, to become appointed is no easy task. It requires, if you are starting out, a minimum bond of $20,000. If you've been in business for at least 2 years, it reduces to 10 and has a maximum amount of $70,000. The airline ticket security is another issue that it requires either safety deposit box or very strict standards for safes that can be kept on site. The Airline Reporting Corporation requires each authorized agency location to have a full-time employee with at least 2 years minimum full-time industry experience. So a person that has had a year of experience could never become an independent contractor if they so desired registering with ARC. It is not a trivial task to receive the appointments. And the individuals that seek independent contractor relationships are making independent business choices to align themselves with organizations that have the ability to issue airline tickets. So again, this is a business decision, and you can separate it from the fact that they themselves make a conscious choice about how they want to conduct their business. The language in the current language of Senate Bill 323 is very similar to the historical language or the past language of the same bill. And the legislation says an individual or business entity providing the labor or services is free from direction and control over the means and manner of providing the labor or services. I would offer up to you a couple of items. I do have independent contractors work through World Travel. Several years ago, I had an independent contractor that walked away from a $3 million business. And in so doing, she made a conscious choice about her business that I was not able to intervene. I didn't step in. It wasn't my right. It wasn't my choice. It was not my business. But it did financially impact me. If you were to ask me today about the revenue of my organization, I can talk to you in general figures. I know how much money it generates, but I could not give you any specific information about any of the sales themselves. I couldn't outline to you how much we do to Asia, to Europe, South America, whether it's cruise, tours, cars, hotels. I don't know that. I only talk in generalized terms about performance in dollars. The Employment Division's ruling in 1999 with All Star Travel, which essentially bankrupted a company, threw the entire industry within the state into a state of unknowing. It is not clear to me that I am in full compliance, even though today I can honestly say that each of our independent contractors does qualify by the four or more following criteria that would recognize them as independent contractors. So that is why I'm here to request the amendment for Senate Bill 323 so that there is an ability for this industry, which has undergone radical change, experienced severe economic losses, that we have an opportunity to function as independent contractors, which is an innovative way that agents have chosen to survive this industry. I would say to you that we as an industry are not looking for a handout. We are looking for a hand up. I understand the issues of taxation. We are running organizations, as I said, that recognize and qualify individuals that choose to align themselves through us. So I would hope that you would make strong consideration to the amendment on behalf of this industry. And I invite any... Oh, I did have one thing. And I want to just also say where Paula had specified that ARC is not the only means by which a ticket can be driven. And so I would propose to Representative Kitts that by selling a ticket through an internet site, does that qualify the agent
to become an employee of either the airlines or a web-based company?
Representative Kent.
It's my job to ask the question. No, I differentiate because I think you have the customer as the middle ground there. I don't think that you are selling the specific airlines or required to sell to a specific airline. I think that you have options. However, you only have one customer that you are shopping for a myriad of airlines. So the answer to your question is no.
They would not become an employee
of the airline.
But they're generating an airline ticket.
I think they're generating, it's not for a specific airline. They have the ability to shop, whether it's Delta or the company formerly known as United, X, Y, and Z. I don't think you're regulated to a specific. I think that if they're required to use a specific airline and didn't have options, so as a means of your employment, you must therefore sell our ticket.
We don't make that distinction. We actually allow the agent to make decisions based on the best interest of their company and on behalf of the customer themselves.
Right. So the answer to your question is no. I don't think they become an employee of the airline because it's not a specific entity in which you have to do business through. In the case of a travel agent, you have to go through a specific entity that has this ARC number in order to do what it is that you're doing. That's the hang-up for me. That requirement right there says that you're not truly independent in my mind.
But the agent themselves that has aligned itself to an agency for ticketing is going to make a choice. Do I go through that agency? Do I circumvent and go to the airlines? Do I go to a website that does a browsing and shopping on the Internet? So at that time, they're free to make any decision and choose any path that they so desire. By working with a web-based company, they also have appointments. They need to distribute dollars. And the appointments of ARC represents 30,000 travel agencies and corporate business locations. They distribute $65 billion in travel sales each year. A web-based organization still means that requires that distribution channel.
Follow up.
Yeah, she can't follow up to me. I've got a question that will relate right back to you. In reading the bill, the way the bill is written, it says, for the purposes of subsection 2B of this section, a person is considered to be customarily engaged in an independently established business if any of the three of the following requirements are met. Simplified, of the aforementioned, I'm about to say, three of them have to be met and you can qualify as an independent contractor. For your purposes, and I'm using the example of the individual that's sitting at home in their home office, working on their computer, taking phone calls on their cell phone that conducts the business that you guys do. So that person would, in fact, maintain a business location as long as it's separate from the business or work of the location for whom the services are provided, which it qualifies for that. The person makes a significant investment in that business through means such as purchasing tools or equipment necessary to provide services. Computer would be required. You couldn't do your business without a computer or cell phone. So I think that would qualify. Or paying for licenses, certificates, or specialized training required to provide the business services. So if, in fact, you get a business license specifying that I am Derek Kitts Travel, broker, whatever you want to call it, I think that I would have met that qualification. Also, the person has the authority to hire other persons to provide or assist in providing the services and has the authority to fire those people. I would assume that that person working under those conditions could hire Mike Schaffler to say, hey, I'm really busy here, my phone's ringing off the hook, but as I book these specific things, I need you to mail confirmations for me to these folks. I'm going to pay you $8 an hour to do that. Now,
18.
Yes, that
dear kids, Travelocity may help you.
This doesn't hit the prevailing wage threshold. I apologize, Representative. But that being said, now you've met four qualifications, because I can hire the good representative and pay him whatever we negotiate out. And if the good representative doesn't do the job, I have the ability and the authority, as the bill is written, to fire that person for not performing the job. So there's four qualifications that your specific industry meets, as far as I can see. It also goes on the last line that says, and this is what Representative Brown was referring to, when the individual provides services through a business entity such as a corporation or a limited liability company, the provisions in subsection 2, 3, or 4 of this section may be satisfied by the individual or business entity. So when the chairman is saying that just because I file with the state doesn't guarantee me that independent contractor status. However, in this case, if you met four plus did that, which I'm assuming that everybody out there that you had stand up probably does three to four of those things already, why the need for a specific exemption if you already meet the exemption qualifications?
The original language, if you look at the document, it also outlines the similar criteria, not a lot of difference. And yet, the suit that was filed against All Star Travel, the argument that the employment division made was specific to ARC. They chose that battle. I didn't. I need protection against that argument, because I'm meeting all of those standards. That's why it's crucial that we have something that affords us an ability to circumvent that argument, because that language existed. If you look at it, it is virtually the same. You've reduced it to three criteria in this new bill.
Right.
It was originally four. We had individuals that meet those criteria. In the findings of fact, I've looked at the All-Star case, and in the hearing process of All-Star, the employment division said, everyone says that they have the ability to hire or fire an employee, but nobody has acted on that, and in so doing, they chose the argument that it did not exist. So even though they have individuals that say, I have met all of this criteria, they have found a means to bypass that and created an argument that is detrimental to this industry within the entire state. I know that I have compliance with everyone that has linked or issued an airline ticket through my organization, and yet I am in fear of an audit by this division, because there is no question that an audit, the legal fees, the time involved, the process itself will likely bankrupt a company. And that is why we're here today, because we need protection against a division of this state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffler.
You know, I ma'am, with all due respect, I take issue with that. I think auditing is one of the review things we have to make sure states, companies are working within and complying with the law. I take issue with that statement, with all due respect. My question is, and if there's someone who's being rude or unprofessional or is exaggerating or misinterpreting the law, I'm very interested in hearing about that, but I do take issue with that statement, with respect. Are you familiar? I was just informed that, and maybe you can respond to this and have more knowledge of it than I do, that if your exemption were to become law, you'd be subject to certain federal taxes that you're currently not subject to. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Okay. I was just informed about myself.
I do have a question. Is it your belief that if we meet the criteria that we do not have, there's no grounds for the unemployment division then to raise argument with an operation?
I believe that's what the statute says now, so I would have to say yes. if you're meeting the criteria of the statute, you're working, then you're complying with the law. That's true for anything, any issue that we see in here. So I'd have to say yes.
Mr. Chair, I just had one follow-up, and I'm more than happy to yield to good Representative Schaffler. I understand your concern, and I would not take issue with what you said, because I think there are vindictive state agencies out there, and that's not a right-wing conspiracy. I think it's a fact, and I think that you can provide caseload. That being said, I would like to see a provision in this situation where if, in fact, because if your criteria is met and they deny it, it's pretty laid out. Boom, boom, boom. Here's my documents that meet these criteria. Now, if they want to argue with that, then I would like to see that. I'd like to see the case that you speak of, because I don't have it in front of me. But that being said, if in fact the audits division or any division wants to come in and contest these things, I would like to see the audits division be 100% liable for the cost if the employer in this situation is not found to have done anything wrong. Because I do think that just by invoking an audit or anything, it's a huge cost to you folks, at no cost to the state other than taxpayer-funded audits. So I would have no problem looking at something on the backside of that, but I do think that the representative brings up good points. We've got to have provisions that make sure people aren't abusing the system, but protecting those that are abiding by the law, as I think that your entity, I don't think your amendment's necessary. I honestly don't, because I think that you meet the criteria. And if, in fact, the Employment Department deems you not to have met the criteria, then I would challenge that. And if they're deemed, and you win that situation, I think they should be liable for the costs that are incurred to you, because you've done nothing but obey the law and been subject to something that the state has triggered, nothing by fault of your own self.
My understanding that the Employment Division is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is basically its own judge and jury. Is that,
Mr. Chair, can we move on? And I want to say, one person's opinion of vindictiveness is another person's opinion of a state agency or a law enforcement agency making sure people comply with the law, whether it's this issue, ma'am, or any other issue. But I really don't. I think this conversation is getting out of the focus of what we're doing here. And I humbly request that we move on.
And I don't disagree with that. We just share a need of hearing a couple other bills. We do have to move on. And I think we've thrashed this issue around very well. And I appreciate your testimony in coming today. And again, I apologize. The other day we had to cut you short. And I thank you for coming back.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on Senate Bill 323? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 323, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1006. We'll jump out of order here a little bit. Yeah, I think so. Bob's here. Yeah. Janet, can you tell us what 1006 does?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the amendment does.
I think it removes, I'm not sure. I haven't seen it, but I know what I heard.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass this out. It was like the original.
You can talk to that. Huh? Here they come.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1006. Would require public contracting agencies to document their determination of the lowest responsible bidder on a form that's prescribed by the Commissioner of Labor and Industries, and to submit the form to the Commissioner. Under current law, they're required to consider certain information when determining a lowest responsible bidder before awarding the public improvement contract, and 1006 would require them to submit the documentation of that determination.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have, Bob? You weren't signed up on here, but did you want to give some testimony?
Can I have Mr. Petty come up?
Sure.
I'm Shipwreck, Oregon Building Trades, and I must apologize. I can't remember if we had a hearing on this.
No, this one's brand new.
This is the first one. Okay.
Yeah, but we had one.
Senate Bill 1006 was introduced at our request to try and conform public contracting to the existing law that exists in Chapter 279, which attempts to define what a responsible bidder is. Under public contracting law, an agency is required to take the lowest responsible bid. Well, it's pretty simple to figure out who's low. You just look at the numbers, but trying to define who is, if that is a responsible bid, is somewhat more difficult. The statute does take a stab at it. I can't cite the section. Dugan can do that, but frankly, the law has not been used very often. Even with this change, I don't think it will be an impact that will occur even daily, certainly not. What we're trying to get at, Ms. Chairman and Committee, is giving local governments, the state, public contracting agencies the tools in order to determine whether their low bidder is indeed responsible. It would allow a public contracting agency now clearer guidelines to reject a bid if they feel it's not in their public interest to accept that bid because maybe they've had a history of poor performance. I don't want to spend a lot of time, but I'll just recite a few stories that led to the introduction of the bill. I was working as I call them, my circle of friends on public contracting issues a couple sessions ago, and there was an attorney from the city of Portland, pretty sophisticated contracting agency, bemoaning the fact that they repeatedly had to award contracts to a particular contractor who routinely never finished the last job they were on. They would get down to what we call the punch list. It's about they've been paid for 95% of the job and walked away from it. And we said, you know, that's crazy. You're still going to do business with these people? And they said, well, yeah, we have to because they're low. So we worked at that time, put the responsible language in there, which, by the way, is copied almost word for word from the federal procurement law. More recently, you had a situation in my county in Clackamas where a contractor, to my knowledge, had never built a school, got a very large school in the Clackamas High School District, absolutely failed. They were thrown off the job and subsequently ended up on a project at Sherwood, and the same thing happened. They went back to California after that. But we feel that if public contracting agencies really examined the qualifications of the contractors like you would in the private sector, and they discover that they really don't want to do business with this particular contractor, they could reject the bid. The last, I guess, the freshest thing that comes to mind, and you folks have probably already heard about it, was a project in Coos County. There was actually a state and county financed natural gas pipeline, which is still in litigation. A good friend of mine is a county commissioner down there, Nikki Witte, and I talked to her about it, and she was very frustrated, and she said, Bob, we had to award the contract to them, and what we should do is change the law. So that's when I got to thinking, okay, because talking to county councils and the attorneys that some of the public contracting agencies have, they're just simply unaware of what they can do, and in fact, not only what they can do, but in my opinion, their rights and responsibilities, managing taxpayer funds to see that the projects are done correctly. Specifically, what this bill would do would require a form, which is in statute. You'll see that when we get the amendments from LC, although Dugan's got a preliminary draft. that the public contracting agent's one page, and when you've got a low bidder, the public contracting agency, before they actually sign the contract, will go through this short list of issues, you know, record of satisfactory performance, integrity, things like that, check it off. We hope to actually interview these people. I learned during the course of this bill that people sign multi-million-dollar contracts and never talk to the person that they're signing these contracts with. I thought was interesting. This form, then they would check whether they were responsible or not. That would then go to the Construction Contractors Board and be delivered. The intent here, so it's clear, is that we want to do something proactively so that the public contracting agency must go through this brief analysis of their low bidder. There's something that they have to do to ensure that, to the best extent they can, that the contractor meets the qualifications, has the experience, has the management skills, the equipment to perform this type of work. And obviously, it would be a lot of this information would be collected or sent in by the contractor, hopefully showing, I've built schools before. These are the schools I've built. This is who it's for. And gosh, maybe even the public contracting agency might call somebody and go, how'd it work out? You know, did they sue you, or was it a disaster? Did you throw them off the job? Whatever. But it would rarely be used. But when you have these construction disasters, they are significant. And I'll stop there.
Representative Escobar?
Yes, I'm surprised, though, that in conjunction with an RFP, we're not using the RFQ process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you're telling me is a pretty good-sized community here didn't do an RFQ.
That's correct.
I mean, that's astounding to me, I guess, is what I'm saying, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobar, I've... Let's see, how should I be kind about this?
We can read it in your face.
I've had this conversation with my circle of friends repeatedly, that there are tools available to them, and sophisticated contracting agencies do the RFPs, the RFQs. I wish they'd do more pre-qualification. It's all in the statutes, but unfortunately, most contracting agencies, even today, still do design, bid, build. And in many cases, that's okay. You've got a complete set of plans and things like that. I wouldn't do it, but you also have some pushback from the contracting agency. It has been controversial about whether or not a contractor is now going to be the type that goes in with on these, we call them exempt projects. CMGC is another way they can do it, versus those contractors who have traditionally done design, bid, build. But that's the very issue we're trying to get at. What this process would end up doing, Representative, would bring the good features of CMGC or the RFQ into design, bid, build. Then you'd be looking at the issues that you would traditionally see in those other types of contracting.
Dugan?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division. Bob's right. One of the fundamental tenets of public contracting is the award of a low bid to a responsible bidder who's got a responsive offer. And that term responsible has the general meaning that the bidder has the capability of performing the particular contract or the ability to obtain that performance. And that is so fundamental and basic, because without that, we're simply awarding to the low bidder and not really serving the public's interest, because we're not ensuring that somebody actually has the capability of doing the public's work at the money that they did this project for. About three, maybe four sessions ago now, there was a bill that enhance the responsibility determination and set criteria out for what constitutes a responsible bidder. And that's basically that they have the personnel, the plant, and the financial wherewithal to do the job, and that's currently in ORS 279C375. Also, they have to have a satisfactory record of performance, and they have to have a satisfactory record of integrity. So that basic criteria has existed for some time, and I think we're still trying to understand how to use that. And in Bob's examples, I think, are cases in the public sector where the public contracting officer hasn't thoroughly made that determination, even though that's in statute. What this bill would do is it really creates, and in the Dash 1 amendment, once we have them and see them, I think you'll see a checklist in there that identifies the contractor, identifies the particular contract. I believe the amendment will identify their construction contractor's board number. And then it will simply require the contracting agency to check off that they have reviewed these criteria that's set out in statute and signed that they've determined the contractor to be responsible or non-responsible. And then that form is sent to the construction contractor's board. My understanding is they would then file that form with that particular contractor's file, so it would be available for future agencies to look at. It would be public information. You could go back and look at that when you're doing a determination. So this is a first step, and probably and kind of a, I think at least a several part solution to the problem. It's a first step in making sure that agencies are in fact doing what they should be doing to make this determination. It doesn't change the criteria currently set out in statute. What else has to take place here, I think, is there has to be a better general understanding of what's behind that. What do you do when you determine responsibility? And we have to get some experience with it. We've got limited experience at this point, and I think, frankly, public agencies are a little bit timid about exercising this because they're probably going to get protested when they determine somebody to be non-responsible. So we've got to develop some background, and we've got to kind of pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps to some degree around this and train on it. There's been some discussion about getting together during the interim on a voluntary basis by public owners and stakeholders and talk about best practices, because there are some agencies out there that are doing a pretty good job at this, sharing that, getting those best practices, and then feeding this information to the Department of Justice, because Department of Justice at the end of session will have an obligation to update their model rules around this. And they've told us that they would be happy to put some of this information in commentary to make it easier for public agencies to follow this and use these examples. So this bill doesn't solve what I think is a fairly complicated problem, but it's not likely to be something that can be completely fixed in statute. But it is a good step to making sure that people are filling this out, that they are making this determination. If they're filing it with the CCB, then the next step for us and the stakeholders is to get together and really raise up these best practices and ask DOJ to incorporate them in their commentary when they adopt model rules.
Thank you, Dugan. Any questions? Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really commend this bill. I think it's something that has been in statute that we really haven't followed very well, and it's maybe been difficult to follow and need some definition. But you bring up best practices, and I just have a scenario that I was curious what your thoughts are, whether this would be responsible or not, because I've talked to a few contractors that get frustrated with this process of not ending up being underbid by a particular contractor that has a history of just lowballing every contract they bid, and then later on making up for that by doing continual change orders and charging the contracting agency more and more and more, and at the end of the project they end up being the high bid, but they got the job.
Right.
It seems to me like that practice would not be a best practice that could be utilize under this statute to determine a contractor had a history of doing that repeatedly, mm-hmm. and basically ensuring that they get the job and bilking the contracting agency for more money than they had budgeted. So would that scenario fall into this as being a reason to disqualify a bidder?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, it could fall into the reasons if there's sufficient documentation to say that there's not been satisfactory performance on prior contracts. But the whole business of contract administration and contractor selection is fairly dynamic. This, if you think about it, is almost the filter on the front-end award process. It's making sure, based on due diligence, that this contractor has the capability of doing the work. Now, the fact that you've made that determination and that they do have the capability of performing the work doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get good performance out of them. This doesn't substitute for contract administration and contract compliance and good specification. The contracting officer still has a job to do to make sure that they're getting the performance that's expected under the contract and that they're managing that contract appropriately. Now, if you have a situation where there's a repeated history of failures on the contractor to do what the contract required, and it's not on the previous contracting agency because the specifications weren't clear or because they didn't do their job, but this contractor constantly didn't do the work, then I think that information, if it's based on documentation, can come into this decision and can be used as a basis for determining that the contractor's compliance hasn't been satisfactory. Each case really has to stand on its own, and it's based upon a determination about that contractor's capability and the contracting officer's best due diligence judgment about whether or not that contractor reasonably can support that they can do the work. Do they have the experience? Have they had successful contracts completed in the past and so forth? Does that answer your question?
I think so. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
John O'Shell, please. We've been missing the name, but they don't have the membership. Yeah, that takes out of good morning, John.
Good morning, Chairman Brown, members of the committee. John O'Shell, Association of Oregon Counties. Not here in opposition to the bill, just really have some concerns that people are going to have the perception this solves the problem. And we really don't think it does. There will be some places where potentially you're going to get some people looking that maybe weren't looking before. So, okay, there's a benefit there. But when you listen, or at least as I listen to the examples I am hearing of where we have problems, we're talking it's being done by pretty good, competent folks who know the business, and they feel like they don't have the backing in the law and the case law to make the decisions that need to be made. This bill doesn't solve that problem. When you get down to it, now there's the thing on the financial ability, and there's the bonding procedures out there, and you know usually you deal with that. There's a qualified for an existing project, and certainly agree with the statements before. If you're getting into a specialty school, specialty jail, you ought to be going through some sort of pretty rigid pre-qualification project. It does get tricky because you can't tell a contractor, well, you can only build a school if you've built a school before. I mean, so it's not a nice, clean line, but agree there should be some processes there. And when those haven't happened, they should. But most of the issues where you're really hearing the problems, it has to do with we're supposed to reject based on satisfactory record of performance, no definition. Satisfactory record of integrity, no definition. The law does say pretty clearly, says, you know, if you are going to reject, you better have some documentation as well, and requires you to have documentation. But when we say, where are we going to go to find that? It's just a big vacant out there. There's no place we can go to say who's causing a problem. There's no place we can go to say, hey, where's the case law for guys who have been rejecting and did it stick? So my perception is says we want to go through a process, get a form. That's a start, and a finished process, I think it is an important step to have. You get it all turned into one place. Right now, by the law, it goes to Construction Contractors Board. Good place. according to the law, it goes in the drawer, disappears. Now, I think the Construction Contractors Board will probably exceed what the law says. They'll at least get it filed by a contractor, so when we called up a contractor, we can find out if anyone else has rejected this contractor. But I think it'd be really useful if we'd had something out there that says, okay, agencies, here's the ones that are being rejected. You can go in here and find out why they were being rejected, what documentation was used to reject them, and did it stick? Then we can start developing something that tells us, here's something we can use. Here's some information we can use to start rejecting the bad guys. Right now, we've got the form coming in. All right, so I'll have some people maybe looking at it that weren't before. But when you look at the ones that are out there that have been causing problems, it's because those people didn't feel like they had the information necessary to do the rejection. That's where we need to go to the solution. Am I opposed to the bill? No, the bill is the right step in the right direction. But it really, I don't want us walking out of here thinking we solved the problem. Thank you.
Did it make it any worse, though?
I always have a concern when we throw paperwork at a problem without an answer. I mean, we are bureaucracy, but gee, we don't like to get real good at it.
Mm-hmm. What do you got against the paper industry?
Yeah.
It's important to my district.
You got the wood fiber industry supporters
up there. Yeah, sorry.
Is there any questions of John? I don't see any. Thank you for your testimony, John. Jessica, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with AGC. I'll be very brief, but just wanted to put a couple of things on the record. We also support this legislation, but I do want to caution the committee that the form that's being created is not you add up all of the numbers, and then if they're good and they make so many good marks and they get accepted. If they don't, they get rejected. And it's that way for a reason. Our concern as the construction industry, or there are times where a contractor and an agency just don't get along. It's the agency's in a pain, or the contractor's not in a good mood, and there are claims filed and lawsuits that occur sometimes legitimately. If you've been around the business for any length of time, chances are you've run into a problem with a wage claim here or there. You may have been late. You may have had to make change orders. There are instances where a contractor legitimately makes business errors, but that doesn't make them a bad contractor. They may have had a problem, gotten thrown off a job 5 years ago, and completely changed their business model. So making a responsibility determination is not just looking at one or two things and saying, oh, they're good or oh, they're bad, but it's a complicated process that, like Dugan and John have said, to date, there is nothing backing the agency up. They have no guidelines on what responsible means, no guidelines on what integrity means. And saying to them, well, you should have just known, I think what we've always advocated is if you're going to have this law, you need to give them something to hang their hat on so they don't just get sued every time that they make these determinations. And when they do, they're for a good reason. Secondarily, we also want to clarify that doing an exempt process, a CMGC process or a design-build process, doesn't necessarily guarantee you that you're going to end up with any better of a contractor than in a design-bid-build environment. That's the only way you're guaranteed if you're going to have better contractors, if you're going to go through the process and pay attention. Because you can go through a CMGC process and get somebody quickly, cheaply, and still end up with the same issues unless you're willing to put the work and time and effort into making sure you're doing business with a good contractor. There is a use for exempt processes, but there's also a good place for the traditional design bid build. AGC supports both, and we don't want to see either of those go away, or one preferred over the other, because we believe that one doesn't necessarily guarantee you a better product than the other. It depends on the project.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Schaffer.
Jessica, I think the pay attention part's exactly right. We have a lot of great contractors. I think often the contracting agency, I can think of examples in my head where they were warned and they thought they were cutting a hog in the rear end, and they end up getting burned because they thought they were going to save money with the low bid, and they didn't.
Yep.
So I think, you know, there's just a thimbleful of common sense, and a lot of this will get us a long way. I do support the bill. I think it is a step in the right direction.
And we do, too.
I thank you for coming on in. I just wanted to point that out.
Representative Kitts.
Jessica, explain to me, if you will, line 21 of the bill. Again, I'll go back to a satisfactory record of integrity, period. Because this, on line 9, it says, in determining the lowest responsible bidder, comma, a contracting agency shall do all of the following. So if, in fact, Boley determines that that person doesn't have quite the integrity that we would like, that's it. They're disqualified. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, that's correct. The contracting agency is guaranteed to get sued, and it will take a while and hold up the project, which is why some of these determinations aren't made, just because it wouldn't be Boley necessarily making that determination. It'd be whatever agency you're doing business with. This law, though Bob Shiprock was correct, it was taken from federal procurement law, but when a federal, we're talking big federal agencies, defense contractors, etc., this law was designed for big federal contracts with people like Boeing and others, where you have two or three bidders on billion-dollar contracts. And this law was taken and put into Oregon law, which isn't exactly the same kind of environment. So making it work for Oregon is very different than trying to make it work at the federal level, where they have some different set of criteria that work with very large companies on very large scale projects. It is very unclear to agencies and to contractors, quite frankly, for that reason, what the law means in terms of satisfactory record of integrity. That's the problem with the law today, is it's unclear, it's not easy to use, it gives no guidelines, so agencies can't just say, okay, well, I can look at these three or four things and then make a judgment based upon the answers to these three or four things about whether they have integrity. So that's the reason why there's a commitment to sit down in the interim among the parties and try and figure out how can we provide at least some standards by which an agency can then make a decision based upon the facts of the case. Because they don't have that today. They have nothing to hang their hat on, no rules, no nothing, and that means they're just going to get sued.
The language that's currently in this, I have real heartburn over, because I think that it allows for agencies, if you will, and I would never accuse anybody of this, but I think it allows for the ability, based on the language, for a huge discriminatory process based on a myriad of different things, you know, and just because of the vagueness there. And I mean, it could be everything from your sexual orientation to the color of your skin to whatever the case, because there's too many satisfactory record of performance, a record of integrity. Well, it's just so vague. I mean, I'd like to see some parameters, because you could say, I don't like that person, and then try to find some reason based on this vagueness over here to disqualify that person. I like what the bill is aimed at, the direction it's going, but I've got a problem with B and C and the vagueness there, because I think it opens the door, the floodgates, to that perspective.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, we've shared that same concern for quite some time, and we're looking forward to putting some sidebars there so we know what we're talking about.
Jessica, B and C in here, this exists in statute now.
Mr. Chair,
we're not adding these to the statute.
No, but I do think it's time for us to put some parameters so the agencies know what it means and we know what it means, so there isn't this question is it a personal thing or is it a legitimate thing. Agencies have been very tepid to use it because they are afraid of getting sued and they are afraid of it looking like they're promoting favoritism. So I think they have used it very judiciously to date, and quite frankly, often not at all. So I do think it's time to make it clear, but Representative Kitts, your concern is very much the same that AGC shares, that we're very concerned about what current law is and how vague and unclear.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, I realize that that's an existing statute. What concerns me is that we are, looks to be adding another layer of bureaucracy to make the determination upon the aforementioned. And that is my concern, because I think Pandora's box becomes open at that point. But
Representative Shaw,
Mr. Chair, I think Pandora's box has been opened up. At my
school district's high school, the overpass up in my neighborhood, the pipeline, and I agree with clarifying the law, absolutely. And I think we are creating statute to discriminate, and very clearly that's our intention, discriminate between legitimate good contractors and poor contractors. That's the goal here, to discriminate. And I'm not against clarifying the law, giving people something to hang their argument on. But I can assure you, it would be whether or not they were capable and competent contractors, not if they were a sexual orientation or religious beliefs, or if they're associated and friends with Representative Kitts. And that's not what we're talking about. You know, I don't think that's what we're talking about. So I just want to make very clear that that kind of argument will never be able to be used. Or if your brother-in-law owns the company or not, or that I'm not concerned about.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, I would say that unfortunately that argument that I spoke of is the unsaid argument, and I would argue that it is often brought into case.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler and Representative Kitts, I think it's AGC's opinion, so that the conversation the two of you just articulated is exactly our concern about the law. On the one hand, we want to do exactly what Representative Schaffler said, is let's weed out those that are poor performers in the industry that my members, quite frankly, don't want to compete against. But at the same time, we don't want what's happening or what could happen under Representative Kitts' scenario to happen. Thus, we need to sit down and provide some real clear guidance about what we're talking about here. So we aren't talking about the kind of things that we fear and Representative Kitts fears, but we are getting at what Representative Schaffler wants to do.
She agrees with both of us.
That's because she's a highly intelligent woman.
Thank you.
Oh, now you bring gender into it? See?
highly intelligent professional.
Okay, where are we at?
Well, shut up.
Oh, man. Is there anyone else has questions of Jessica? I don't see any. Thank you, Jessica. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 1006?
Thank you for pointing out that.
And if not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1006. And then before I open the hearing on Senate Bill 477, Janet's going to... this bill, 477, will look a great deal different from what the present bill is. And so I... and given the time restraints... And
you want to postpone it since we don't have the language right here in front of us?
Okay. I think I'll hold 477A over till Friday, and we'll start that conversation that day. And with that, we can be adjourned.